Not ready? Too bad. Head back, face forward, and hold on like you mean it.
Hello and welcome to the Review Time Podcast. This is a weekly show where we discuss all the ins and outs of attractions and parks from around the world. My name is Luke Carroll, and I will be your host on this slightly different episode of the show. Today, instead of talking about a single ride, we'll be taking a look at an entire cancelled project, Project Gemini at Epcot, the early 2000s plan to revitalize Epcot's future world. But I'm not here to explore the project alone. Please welcome the only man I was brave enough to do the Beverly Challenge with. It's Review Time co-host Dominic Lacey. How you going, Dom?
I regret that challenge even to this day. I don't think that I have ever been as sick from a beverage, and I'm well over the age of 18 as well, than I did from the Beverly Challenge. That was just disgusting.
I honestly think that's the sickest I've ever been in a theme park, and it had nothing to do with a ride. Do you want to give a viewers, a listener, sorry, a quick overview of the Beverly Challenge? So they're not just like, what are they talking about?
Well, we at Club Cool at Epcot, they have all of these sodas from around the world, one of them being Beverly, which is an aperitif from Italy.
Italy, yeah. And but they don't the make Beverly- it anymore, from what I learned. It's literally only produced, well, until it closed, it was only produced for Club Cool. Even Italy didn't want it anymore.
We don't want this, please. But it's very bitter. It's very not good, and it's garnered a bit of a meme reputation for Epcot. But we pretty much just sat there and tried to drink as much as we could. We just kept on one after the other, kept going.
Every time we walked past Club Cool, wherever we were heading in the park, we had to stop in and do a Beverly, and I think that was the day that I got incredibly sick with you. And I think it's because we were going back and forth between the two sides of Future World a lot with, you know, fast passes or trying to ride Soarin' and Test Track. It was relatively quiet. Yeah, that's the sickest I've ever been in a theme park. So thanks, Beverly. If Club Cool never reopens, I don't know if it will be a bad thing, honestly, because we never have to do the Beverly Challenge again.
Well, just quickly, we'll go off on a tangent before we get deep into it. Have you ever seen the original design for Club Cool, where it's like an actual igloo and there's like an ice expedition out the front? It wasn't just the building that it was themed. It was quite interesting.
Taking the literal version of the word cool there.
Yeah.
I have not. I'll have to have a look at that myself. But today we are, as we were saying, we're talking about something slightly different. So we're talking about Project Gemini at Epcot. This was the early 2000s, so around 2003. It was meant to be done in 2006, and this was meant to completely change Future World at Epcot, because as I'm sure you would know, and all the listeners probably understand as well, the Tomorrowland issue, which is Tomorrowland eventually becomes Todayland and then the Past Land, was also an issue at Future World. When Epcot opened, it had the tagline of "The 21st Century Begins October the 1st, 1982. And the whole park was looking forward to the 21st century, so 2000. Once 2000 came around, it wasn't exactly looking like 2000 anymore, but just a concrete 80s version of what they thought the future might look like in 20 years' time.
I feel like everyone had this idealistic of what the turning millennium would be. You know, we all had it. There were going to be hoverboards and flying cars, and everything was going to be this sleek Art Deco style that Epcot had. Or at least I think it's Art Deco. It's very angular and colorful. And then it rolled around, and it was pretty much, I remember a prominent architectural styling was pretty much just brown. Which goes well for some of the re-themes of Tomorrowland, like Brown Space Mountain.
Is an interesting word for it.
But it just wasn't as exciting as everyone wanted it to be.
All I remember from 2000 is the Sydney Olympics, and I'm sure that's just because I'm an Australian. I'm sure for anywhere else in the world, you'd just be like, oh boy, a new millennium, the same thing as yesterday.
I was actually born on the day that the Sydney Olympics were announced, fun fact.
I thought you were going to say that they, you know, they debuted, they opened. I was like, you are a lot younger than I thought you were than you've ever told me.
I'm 20. no, so I was born on the day that they, like, the International Council sort of came out and said, Sydney is getting the Olympic Games. And my parents were legitimately going to call me Sid.
It would have been named after one of the mascots, Sid Millie and Ollie, the 2000s Olympic mascots.
The kookaburra was my favorite. Oh,
top tier. Anyway, back to Epcot. So.
Nice Epcot, tangent.
That is the biggest tangent we've ever been on the show. Epcot opens 1982. It's completely different to everything else because it's not, you know, single attractions that might be based off, you know, an idea or a movie or something like that, but it's entire pavilions based around single themes and everything inside is, you know, tied to that theme. And Epcot opened with what I would say are some of, still to this day, the best dark rides of all time. And we've had this discussion before. It's, do you feel that today's guests are not willing to sit through a 20, 30, 40 minute attraction like Epcot had opened with? Where now we're looking at, you know, a long attraction is something like Beauty and the Beast, which just opened at Tokyo. And when I saw that was 8 minutes long, I was like, ooh, that's pretty long nowadays. But then I think back to things like Ellen's Energy Adventure, which is 45 minutes. Do you reckon people just don't have the attention span anymore?
No, I actually think that it's a strategic move. So if you look at all of the things that are slightly longer within the Disney Parks ecosystem, all of your experiences like the lightsabers and all of that, they're still experiences that can take upwards of an hour and people are willing to sit through that. But people pay for that. And I think that part of the, you know, the change to shorter attractions is that if you have someone in a ride for 40 minutes watching Ellen do whatever she does. I've never been on that attraction, and my one opportunity to actually ride it, I missed out because I think I was looking for chicken nuggets in Future World.
I think I probably rode it 10 times, and I probably reckon about two of those times I didn't fall asleep at one point. It was the perfect nap ride at Epcot on a hot summer's day.
You were there for a year and you rode it 10 times. I feel like... nine times. Well, one time is enough.
I don't know.
What was the other nine?
I think it was just because it was air conditioned. It was 45 minutes. It never had a queue. So you just knew, you know, for an hour out of your day, you didn't have to worry about anything. You just got to sit, relax, maybe have a little nap. And I enjoyed it. But I don't know if I enjoyed the ride or I just enjoyed the air conditioning for an hour.
Maybe it's similar to the People Mover where you just want to sit down and chill. Mm. See, I think those attractions have cult followings and people really enjoy those. And I think there is room for longer attractions, but Disney are a bit too scared to let people go that long within a building without opportunities to sell them things, essentially. Mm. If someone is relaxing in a building, why not have them relax in a restaurant where they can have a drink, they can have some food? It's that sort of way that they're going. They want to sell things.
Well, what I'd imagine looking, you know, Guardians is replacing Ellen, and I'm assuming it will be around a 4 or 5 minute ride. That's 40 extra minutes you now have of someone to upsell them on food and merchandise and stuff like that compared to if they had have ridden Ellen. So it makes sense. Unfortunately for us, because those longer rides like Ellen, even, you know, in 2015 when I was there, stuff like Ellen and Great Movie Ride, those were good just to chill, relax for a little while. Spaceship Earth is probably the longest that's still surviving. And we'll talk about that a little bit because there was big plans to change Spaceship Earth that all had to change. But anyway, so back to Epcot. It had this initial success. It was really popular at the start, but it couldn't keep up. By the 1990s, only 8 years later, it was already looking out of date, even though it was meant to be looking forward, you know, to 2000s. So Disney, to quick little fixes to bring up the attendance levels, they would introduce stuff like the Flower and Garden Festival, the International Food and Wine, which brought huge, huge numbers to the park to essentially drink and upsell them, exactly what we were saying before. But it still had this underlying issue of the park, and that was that the 21st century, as it got closer, it realized that Epcot's vision of the 21st century was further and further away. So this idea, this Project Gemini, was the early 2000s way of saying, all right, we're going to fix the Tomorrowland issue, the Future World issue, once and for all. So the whole idea was, rather than being Future World, it would be renamed and rethemed into Discovery Land. Discovery Land is the Future World, you know, Tomorrowland at Paris. This almost had nothing to do with that. And I think it was more of that, oh, no, no, Discovery, it's timeless, you know.
Yeah, Tony Baxter struck gold on that. Like, that whole concept when they were going through Paris and they're like, look, guys, we've hit this roadblock so many times with the Tomorrowland idea. Epcot, both Tomorrowlands at Disneyland and the Magic Kingdom. What do we do? And they pretty much said, well, what if we look at the future through the eyes of the past? And it's an incredible way to do it because that is timeless. You're time stamping the future in a different sort of fantastical setting. And Disney just went wild with this. They love that idea. Mm-hmm. And I think Tony Baxter pretty much got thrown every single Tomorrow project because of it. Unfortunately, also being Tomorrowland at Disneyland in the early 2000s, where pretty much all they gave him
Space Mountain is back.
Instead of a budget that you would do a full overhaul, they just gave him a bucket of paint and said, go.
Good luck. speaking of budget, so the entire budget for Project Gemini, this overhaul of the front half of Epcot, was $500 million, which is astronomical when you think the entire DCA project, which was just a couple of years earlier, was only a little bit more than that. What was that, $600 million?
$650 million, from what I remember off the top of my head.
So this is almost the price of the second gate at Disneyland, you know, almost 50 years in the making, just to fix a park that had opened 20 years earlier. So this is almost looking at that DCA 2012 overhaul levels of, we're going to fix this problem and we're going to get it right this time sort of thing.
And it's interesting that this is happening under the Eisner era. So Eisner was still CEO. So he was identifying that he has problems that he needs to fix in his parks while still opening parks that have significant problems. It's sort of a weird overlap there, because this is in the same time that DCA, Walt Disney Studios Park, that they were being opened. There's a bit of dissonance going on amongst them.
It screams, and I'm sure as we go through it, listeners will understand, but it screams very blue sky stage, a lot of it. And I'm sure we'll discuss whether we think it should or shouldn't have gone ahead. But as you entered this new Project Gemini park, if it had been completed as planned in 2006, it would all be open. As soon as you pull into the parking lot, you would notice that something is different. And that is because Spaceship Earth would have been painted gold, ladies and gentlemen. So to join Brown Space Mountain, to join all of that.
Baxter.
Spaceship Earth gold. If you look back at the plans for Westcott, Space Station Earth, which was the bigger version, the icon of the Westcott project, was meant to be gold. So it looks like it was almost a hearkening back to that. And thinking on it, I think Spaceship Earth gold could have actually worked. And it would have worked a lot better than that ugly Mickey one they put on there, for sure.
The Mickey ones, though, to be fair, that was your first time I went to Walt Disney World. So it's got that part in my heart where it's like, I love the Mickey one, but it's also like, why? Why was it there?
Merchandise.
Yeah, true.
So the biggest thing of this whole Project Gemini was this redefinition of Future World into Discovery Land. And there's some links between what it was going to be and what it is looking like it may be today. So they would have gotten rid of all the barren concrete plazas and those plain kind of grayish concrete buildings. And they would have replaced it with greenery, essentially. So everywhere you looked, it would have been trees, waterfalls, winding paths. And the idea was that the land itself would lead you on your own journey of discovery. So it wasn't so much, you know, go to the left if you want to get to, you know, mission space, and go to the right if you want to go to this. The winding paths and stuff, you would just eventually find your way to the attractions and experience them. That was the idea, at least. It screams a lot of guests are going to get lost. I've been standing on Main Street and had a guest come up to me and ask where the castle was. So I don't know how these winding pathways guests are meant to find their way to attraction. I can imagine at 3 a.m. you'd still be finding guests walking around with a park map out. Like, how do I get to Soren?
Where's the Grand Floridian?
But as you enter the park, so this big gold spaceship Earth would have had a brand new attraction in it. So, you know, we currently enter the park. You can go to the left or to the right around Spaceship Earth, kind of. Big construction walls at the moment, but normally you could. If Project Gemini had gone ahead, to the left would have actually been blocked off, and to the right would have been the pathway. So everyone would have gone to the right. Blocked off on the left inside a brand new show building would have been the entrance to a ride. Brand new ride inside the Spaceship Earth, and it would have been called Time Racers. Sponsored by Microsoft, of course, because this is
Unfortunately, Epcot. It was time spelt properly, not T-Y-M-E. We weren't around then.
Racers sponsored by Review Time. But hey, Disney's struggling for money at the moment, apparently. So if they need a sponsorship, I'm sure we could scrape together, you know, $50 and a hat or something.
We've still got those Golden Oaks big dollars. What's that video? It's over 1 million views now.
Oh, come on, Disney. But Time Racers was set to be a hybrid between a roller coaster and a dark ride. And I thought this sounded pretty cool, even though I don't think it ever would have fit inside the Space Mountain Ball. But it would have been a high-speed adventure through time, utilizing both physical sets as well as projections. So those projections that have evolved to be in stuff like Hyperspace Mountain today. So this technology, the projections, though, would have been used to show time-lapse videos. So it would have given you this idea that you were fast-forwarding all throughout human history as you were going. So, you know, kind of on Space Mountain, you've got like the warp tunnel on Hyperspace Mountain. Imagine that, but as you're going, it could be a launch, for example, and racing past you is, you know, the pyramids and Rome and all of this, and you're going through human history, and then at the end you got to the present day, you would have been blasted out the top of the golf ball or outside of Spaceship Earth, whatever you want to call it, and taking a spin outside the show building, which weirdly is similar to the ending of the other big thrill ride in the park, Test Track, which was open at the point. So it seems strange to me that they'd end it the same, but they were going to zoom outside the building and back inside. So that would have been Time Racers.
See, look, I have a internal theory that Michael Eisner may have been afraid of lift hills, because if you look at the majority of roller coasters opened underneath his tenure, they were all launches. Every coaster was, hey, you're going on a journey through something and then you launch. and that was pretty much it. Look at California Screamin', Rock and Roller Coaster, Time Races. Michael Eisner, we're on to you. Buddy, if you need a chat about those lift hills, we're right here.
To be fair, there was a stage when I was younger and I loved launch coasters but hated lift hill coasters for that exact reason. It's like, if you launch me up the top and I get there in, you know, 5 seconds, that's fine. You can take me as high as you want if you launch me. But if you make me go up there like a 1.5 minute lift hill, that's the one that's going to scare me.
One of the first times I ever went to theme parks with Luke, and sorry, Luke, I have to tell this story, but we were on Green Lantern at Movie World. Now, it's like 40 meters, 30, 40 meters.
It's an El Loco, but it's one of those weird four across El Locos.
Yeah, so it wasn't all that high, but Luke was like smack bang in the middle of the train, and as we were going up the lift hill, you were just concrete with your eyes closed. And I'm like, Luke, what's up? And you're like, I hate lift hills. Just so, yeah, we'll get you coasters, a seat next to Michael hills. Eisner.
I'll be happily sitting there. But to me, that sounds like a really cool idea for a ride, but not a really good idea for a ride inside Spaceship Earth. Because that's a big building for a dark ride, but I can't imagine how much you could do with a circular ball shape with a coaster track inside of it.
From the sound of what you were telling me, where you essentially emerge out of Spaceship Earth, it made it sound like you would literally just rise up through it quickly out the top and then sort of do a top hat out and then go around coaster style outside. I think really it falls under that problem of, is it worthwhile replacing Spaceship Earth? Because it's still a really good attraction and it's got a lot to offer still. Would it have been a worthy replacement? Probably not.
It's very that era of Disney where it was trying to be hip and trying to be, you know, we want thrills in the parks. We want to get the teenagers involved.
We all know what it's called, Luke.
Communication.
It's the Breck-Eisner era.
One of my favorite stories of why Splash Mountain came to be was because Michael Eisner took his son Breck to work one day when he was touring Imagineering, and over in the corner, the junior Imagineer Tony Baxter had stored his small little model of Splash Mountain, and all of the senior Imagineers had their big grand projects on the middle table, and Breck walks on over to Splash Mountain and goes, I want to ride that. And hey, now we've got Splash Mountain. Breck had more control of the Disney company than I would say Bob Chapek does today. Let's be honest.
Look, Breck is now a film producer as well.
Yeah, he's a director, so, I think.
Yeah, I believe.
Two people, if they ever want to come on the show, Breck and Michael Eisner. That's the only two guests we'll ever have. If they ever want to come on down. So anyway, you would exit Time Races into this new Discovery Land area with all the greenery. So Fountain of Nations would have still been there. So that's different to the current plans where Fountain of Nations went bye-bye. So that would have been there still, a little bit of familiarity, but everything else would have felt new. This whole hub area here would have redefined the middle of Epcot in that the buildings for Interventions and Communicore were still there, but now they would have been split into six distinct buildings. So they would have, you know, cut through the ones where you could always go left or right. They would have ripped down the buildings and roofs between them. And then the others, they would have split into smaller sections. So if we look at the east side, which is actually the left-hand side, because Epcot is back to front, it goes south to north to south. We would have had Leading Edge, which is just Communicore Interventions again, because you can't have a Disney park in the early 2000s without looking at Asimo the robot.
Look, the perfect excuse is that you can literally just throw in whatever technology you want and it can be any sponsor.
Exactly. Hey, anybody want to show anything off?
What a test audience. Like, oh, you go to a business and it's like, want to test out your technology in front of the general population? Put it at Disney.
Yeah.
It's a win-win for them. So it's understandable why it came back.
I remember the time I was at Interventions at Disneyland seeing the Asimo show and he went to walk up the stairs and fell over. So that was a big thumbs up for Asimo from me as a, you know, a 16-year-old kid.
I love it. Beautiful. Cheering from the crowd.
Speaking of robots, next door would have been the Robot Restaurant, which would have featured BattleBot-like shows on like the half an hour, which sounds really cool to me until you realize that sounds, one, stupidly expensive, or is going to be too stupidly boring because they don't want to break the robots.
Well, that's what I was just thinking at first. We saw Robot Wars live when we were at EB Expo in Sydney. It was one of the most random things we ever came across. It was when I was going through my gaming phase of YouTube back in the Captain Laser Guns era. And we went to EB Expo and they had Robot Wars live. And it was really interesting to watch, but those robots get destroyed.
Yeah, didn't one, like, for maybe it lasted for 5 seconds, the other one just went up and slammed it and it was done. That was it. Match over.
It had, like, a giant hook at the top and it just went crunch, 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 and it was dead. And I'm just wondering, as exactly as you said, how are they going to do this multiple times a day? Otherwise, I'm just thinking it's Rock'em Sock'em Robots and they're just going to keep on whacking each other until one of their heads pops up.
So Robot Restaurant, that would have been where Electric Umbrella was. Moving around, ladies and gentlemen, the best name thing in the entire section, Future Mart, a rename for Mouse Gear, which would have sold Epcot items. You know, when I think of the future, I think of Epcot sweatshirt. That's the most future mart sounding thing I can think of for sure.
It just sounds like when you're watching one of those TV shows and they're like, we got to get in the time machine and go to the future. And then they get there and they're like, yeah. Oh, what's this? It's not 7-Eleven. It's Future Mart. They sell moon pie.
Exactly. A lot of this seems like, we're going to get rid of the timelessness of Future World and still call half of the things with the word future anyway. On the other side of the old Interventions area, you would have had where Club Cool was, you would have had Cool Stuff, which would have included cool stuff of the time, which the only thing I can see was Segways. Which is most early 2000s cool stuff. We can ride a Segway around, which I think Interventions had Segways at one point anyway. So it would have just been moving them from there to there. Like, if you think of 2000s and someone went, what's cool in 2000? People would have been like, oh, yeah, iPods, maybe Segways. Yeah, those were pretty cool.
Sorry, I zoned out and I do not remember reading about this at all. And I just come back to you being like, oh, yeah, they've got a place called Cool Stuff. And inside it had cool stuff.
Cool Stuff. That's the description online of this place. It's Cool Stuff featuring Cool Stuff.
Segways were cool.
Wait till you hear the next building, which is more self-descriptive in the name, Internet Cafe, where Starbucks is today, which would have been a coffee shop where you could browse the internet.
It sounds like someone sat down and, you know, they're really proud of their work. But you know when you write something, it's like 4 a.m. You've been working all day and you're like, yeah, that's good. And you wake up the next morning, you're like, oh, I got to present this tomorrow to Breck and Michael. I'll just go with it. So
you hear those stories of having to, you know, create plans overnight because you got your big pitch meeting in the morning. This screams that. It's like they designed the ideas and then went, oh, we actually have to give everything names. Future Mart, Cool Stuff, Internet Cafe. That'll do. Just put something
Robot
on there.
Restaurant.
And the last of these six buildings would have been Home of the Future, which is a throwback to the old Monsanto Home of the Future at Disneyland. And I believe Interventions at one point did have this sort of like Home of the Future. I think when I went in 2008 to the Disneyland version of Interventions, they had this sort of like, here's an internet connected fridge, which did become a thing, and I still don't know why. So
underneath, I believe it was in the big round building where America Sings used to be. Yeah. You've got two big round buildings in Tomorrowland at Disneyland. One is Space Mountain, the other is that. The only reason I remember
launch
it,
bay now. It's Star Wars launch.
Yes, is because on the top floor they had virtual Magic Kingdom stuff, and you could get the pins.
Ooh,
you know how you could get in-game pins? You could like go around Disneyland. Yeah, but
so that's
I
where you spend your whole day. Yeah, to Disneyland.
Oh, yeah, you know, my one opportunity to go to Disneyland in like that 10-year period, and hell's yeah, I was hanging out at the VMK section. That's what
just 20 more
16-year-old
minutes,
Dom wanted to do at the time. So.
That's what current Dom wants to do, I'm sure, too, if they didn't close it down.
Wait, what? They closed it down?
Oh, I better tell this to you on our break. We'll be right back shortly. This week's episode of the Review Time Podcast is brought to you by our wonderful patrons. For exclusive perks and to show us your support, be sure to check out patreon.com/reviewtime. And we are back. Dom's had his breather about VMK being closed, and we're back to talk about the rest of Project Gemini because it's a huge project and we're probably only about halfway through talking about what it would have been. So we're going to take a left at Discoveryland now and head towards what would eventually be Mission Space. Mission Space was already under construction, so it wasn't technically part of Project Gemini at the time, but it would have opened around the same time. To the left, we would have still had Ellen's Energy Adventure because, of course, you can't get rid of Ellen and Bill Nye and the snake-like dinosaur and that amazing animatronic of Ellen.
Oh, no.
You've missed out.
Timeless Epcot.
Look, I needed a nap still. You know, this was meant to be done in 2006. I was meant to go in 2015 when I lived over there. I still needed a nap, so they needed to keep it open. Wonders of Life would have been officially closed as part of Project Gemini, so that this was one of the things that would have been completely shuttered. But with all the new things being added, it almost, I want to say it would have been fine, because it wasn't like when they did eventually close Wonders of Life and there wasn't all this new stuff, it just kind of quietly shuttered.
Something I've always wondered, why do they hate Wonders of Life so much?
Because like, there was a, what theme park do you go to and figure out how babies are born? That's the Disney image that I don't think they wanted people to think about anymore. Like the making of me.
That is true. That's fair. I do remember when I first went to Epcot in 1999 as a wee little baby. I think I was like 6 or 7 at the time. But I remember Body Wars.
Oh, interesting.
And the only reason I remember it is because as you're like going through the blood and that, after we got off, my dad whispered to me, "Is like, remember, don't touch the walls of the vehicle as you get out. They'll be gross."
True. So
I was like really cautious, and I looked back and there was like nothing on there. It was just really clean. And I was like, that's a missed opportunity. That's when I knew that Disney World was all fake.
Your 6-year-old Imagineering brain was like, if this was fake blood, I would much more be believing this right now.
I was destined to be an Imagineer from the day I was born.
I think that's why they closed it, because you went there and you're like, nope, unbelievable, close it down. We don't need Wonders of Life.
I put it in the suggestion box, and Michael Eisner was like, this one kid from Australia, he touches my heart. Close it all down.
Just for him. So the first new thing that would have been on this side of Epcot would have been in front of Test Track, and it would have been called Autopia Junior, which is a throwback to the old Junior Autopia at Disneyland. But it essentially would have just been a smaller version of Autopia and the Tomorrowland Speedway that would have kind of wrapped around the front of the Test Track building. And it was kind of designed in a way to be like, okay, kids, sorry you can't ride Test Track because you're too short or you're not quite up to the thrilling high-speed ride that it is, but here's something for you to do while you wait. And if you look at kind of the front part of Autopia, over to the left where the new Space 220 restaurant is being built and kind of over to the right, over by the Odyssey building, even under the big like roof of Test Track, it looks like something should be there. Like,
oh yeah,
something's missing.
And it looks like when you look at the map and when you look at that area, it really does feel like Test Track should have something else. Like we'll mention in earlier how it would be awesome if when you're zooming out of Test Track, instead of just seeing around the backstage of Epcot, if there was some greenery and there was some rock work beneath you, and maybe the Autopia track could go in the area where the Chevrolet cars are.
Oh, you don't like the employee car park part of Test Track?
There's usually only like 4 cars there. Yeah. And it says something about the brand.
True. Would have added something, just anything to that end part of Epcot, which is very highway route, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Finale. But that side of the park wouldn't have seen too much new, just the closure of Wonders of Life and Autopia Junior. But over on the other side, almost every pavilion would have seen huge changes. So the Seas Pavilion, which was kind of getting outdated at this point as well, and we're getting to that era of IPs, would have seen an IP injection, but it would have been not from Nemo, which would come a few years later, but it was planned to be from Ariel, so the Little Mermaid. Okay. And it would have been more in that edutainment style, like teaching people through the dark ride about the dangers of pollution and, you know, plastic and oil spills and stuff like that. And ultimately, when you got to the end of the dark ride, you would have been in Triton's Kingdom. And then this was to show you, you know, look after the ocean and we can all live in harmony together in Triton's Kingdom like this. Which
look
I think
at this
is
stuff. Isn't it neat? Homogeneous is not a fish. I can see it. It's a good ring.
Yep. There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Edutainment.
Close Body Wars, but open that song. which I feel is very, the difference of, you know, Ariel compared to what we got with Nemo. Nemo's a little bit more subtle in its like, hey, look after the ocean, where it feels like Ariel would have been about as subtle as a brick to the face. Like, hey, you want to live in my kingdom? You better not have any plastic in the ocean.
King Triton's just there at the end, like assaulting people just with his trident. Just, no,
have you learned your lesson.
But I can picture it with that like sea base alpha, where it's like the aquarium, which somehow I managed to miss when I went to Disney World with you. We did find Nemo.
Did you just close your eyes and just keep walking from the exit? Because it's not possible to miss.
That's what I mean. It was either under refurbishment or we had somewhere we immediately had to be. But I remember riding that with you because we were singing Big Blue World, the only most amazing song. Exactly.
We bet we'll have to do an episode on Finding Nemo the musical in the future, I think.
But then as we left, I do not remember Seabase Alpha, whereas I do when I went back with my now wife when we were on our honeymoon.
Interesting. I remember it just because I like to watch the manatee eat lettuce. He was always eating lettuce. That was the best part. But anyway, so that's Under the Sea. It would have been, the Sea Pavilion would have been renamed to Under the Sea. And then we move around to the Land Pavilion, which would have seen the biggest changes of it all. The land outside would have been completely redesigned. Off to the right would have been a big, lush rainforest. And through that rainforest would have been a suspended family coaster, which I think feels pretty cool. The pre-show would have been, you know, edutainment again, because they didn't quite want to let go of edutainment. So it would have been, you know, about the dangers of logging and all of this, making sure we care for the environment, care for this. And then I see conflicting things online. Some say that it would have been similar to Pterodon Flyers at Islands of Adventure, which is like a small two-person roller coaster that you can only ride if you have a kid with you. And other people say that it would have just been a family suspended coaster. Knowing Disney, it probably would have been more likely to be a suspended family coaster, because Pterodon Flyers is like a couple of hundred people an hour capacity-wise, which doesn't sound Disney.
It also sounds
Disney.
Like a guest relations nightmare, having something that's, you know, at such a low capacity and for only very particular people and groups. You just don't want to deal with that.
Disney.
Always thinks of their, you know, bottom line guest service upwards.
So Rainforest Roller Coaster, which was just called Rainforest Roller Coaster at this point, was kind of, you know, the family version of Time Races. So the Thrill Seekers would go to Time Races and the families would go to Rainforest, just like the Thrill Seekers would go to Test Track and the families would go to Autopia Junior. So it was this design of Epcot to be inclusive for everyone, because it kind of became known as the boring park, and they didn't want to just fix it for one demographic. They were trying to do something for everyone, which I do think, at least ideas-wise, like by number of attractions, maybe not specifics, but I feel that the ideas of, you know, a couple of good family rides, a couple of good thrill rides, a couple of good experiences, a walkthrough, that sort of stuff would have added a lot to the park at this point.
See, looking at this map, I definitely agree with what you said, where this was very much a blue sky, because you can tell that it's a template that they would have gone to executives with. And then what they could do is they could take all of these additions where it's like Future Mart, Cool Stuff, Internet Cafe, Rainforest Roller Coaster, Time Races, everything could be divvied out to Imagineers and just go, all right, you're working on this, enhance the like what we've come up with. So executives would go, yeah, we want Cool Stuff. Then another Imagineer takes
yes,
that.
Please, give me Cool Stuff.
And then they add to it. And I think that's what this is. It's a general sort of look at Epcot.
Overview.
Going, hey, guys, this is what we need. Yeah. And then from there, they would have added to it. Because it's once you dig deeper into Project Gemini that you realize that it's all very top level.
Blue sky.
Is that what
you
thought? Yeah. So there's not really much depth to it. Ocean wide, puddle deep.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the other side, so on the right-hand side of the Land Pavilion would have been the Rainforest Roller Coaster before you enter. on the other side between it and the Imagination Pavilion would have been what I think is a pretty good fit for the space, a hedge maze, which is kind of the middle ground of Imagination and the land, I would say anyway, which would have been just, you know, a nice walkthrough experience similar to what they have in Paris with the Alice's Curious Labyrinth and similar to what they have in Hong Kong with that kind of like princess walkthrough that's semi-maze. Oh. But it's not really. It's the world's easiest maze. If you closed your eyes and just walked, you'd probably find your way to the other end.
It's a good photo op. That's pretty much what it is. And talking to someone who worked on it, they pretty much said that the opportunity was just people like taking pictures in that sort of culture. So they
give
just
them
go
a
there,
place
they
to
get
do
a picture.
It. And then finally, the final edition, which did come true, would be Soarin'. But interestingly, it was meant to be on the other side of the Land Pavilion to where it ultimately ended up. And from day one, it was set to have a original film. And it would have been where you were flying not over California, but flying over different ecosystems. So you would have flown over, you know, the desert, the rainforest, the tundra, you know, the snow and stuff like that.
Please tell me that there would have been more education involved in this, Luke.
Well, I'm pretty sure Epcot is synonymous with edutainment, and my guess is it would have been similar to that, like, awesome planet or something that's in the Land Pavilion now, where it's like, oh, look at this. Isn't the planet sick? Look after it, guys. which is my, I think, 2000s version. But, yeah, so that would have opened with its original film instead of the California version, which never made sense. And then ultimately when they did replace it, everyone kind of went, I preferred when it didn't make sense rather than soaring around the world. So Project Gemini, that's kind of a quick overview of it as a whole. And it really was a big redefinition of Epcot. It would have been a different park from this day. You know, before Project Gemini, when it was struggling, whilst I'm not sure if it's the best way to redefine Epcot, it would have fixed the Epcot issue for sure.
Well, if you look at Epcot, essentially, World Showcase hasn't been touched in a very long time. You got the addition of Morocco, and that's about it. And I think the African Outpost, but pretty much you've got a solid concept and it worked. But the problem that they've always had, as you've said, has been the future world problem. And this was their way of going back and, you know, working on it. But you've sort of touched in your documentation of why it's failed. Did you want to expand on that? Sort of who shut it down? And
yeah, sure. So as I was saying, like, it fixed the Tomorrowland issue, I think it would have fixed, and that was seemingly what they were going for, but it wouldn't have fixed the Epcot issue. It would have just made the park confusing. But the reason it didn't happen was, hey, surprise, surprise, money, because this is Disney, and it always comes down to money. But a different name than usual when it comes down to money, Paul Pressler. We haven't talked about him much. But he, at the time, was just notorious for cutting budgets, cutting plans, cutting staff, cutting maintenance, everything. He's one of, you know, a lot of people hate Chapek for bringing IPs and stuff in, but Pressler was worse, a lot of people would say. A lot of issues that still we see today at parks like Disneyland were because of cuts to maintenance and refurbishments made under his regime. So the plans were shown to Pressler and he went, that's good, but it's very expensive. So come with me, more affordable, and we'll talk about it, essentially.
Look, I got Tony Baxter over here in Disneyland with a bucket of paint in Tomorrowland.
You,
surely you get
$500 million? So he said no, and, you know, it sat in the back as it always does. And then 2002, Pressler was replaced by Jay Rasulo for Parks and Resorts, and Jay Rasulo really liked Project Gemini. He said that this was the smartest way to permanently fix world, to permanently fix Future World once and for all. This idea of discovery is timeless. We can update it. We can upgrade it over time to match new IPs and stuff like that. Discovery is so wide that we can almost fit anything in, and good, let's go for it. Problem was, this was an era where Disney had just opened up DCA. They had just opened up Disney Studios Paris. They were still reeling from the failure of Disneyland Paris.
And the even Animal Kingdom had just opened, and it wasn't doing super well either.
And it just kind of became investors and the higher-ups at Disney from, you know, above the CEO, the outside forces were essentially saying, you need to keep your profits high. And the only way to do it at that point was to keep your costs as low as possible. Disney had made some big, expensive mistakes at the time. And the best way to kind of ride it out and see was just to keep costs low, unfortunately. And when put in front of Eisner with this, you know, directive from the board and the investors, Eisner had no choice but to cut the plans back so much. And that's why ultimately we did get Soarin', but it was the cheaper California version rather than giving them their own film. Mission Space would open, but it was already, you know, under construction, and the Living Seas would eventually get animated characters in 2006, but it was Nemo and Friends, a popular franchise thanks to the, you know, the film a couple of years earlier. But Seabase Alpha is much cheaper to retheme into this new Nemo Seabase Alpha than it would have been to be completely redone into Triton's Kingdom. So the bits and pieces that did kind of make it into Epcot, even those ones were restricted in what they were.
And there's something I want to say about that era of Disney compared to the era that we're seeing now. You know, a lot of people are comparing what we're going into to being very similar to what we'll see in with Michael Eisner in the late days of the early 1990s and the early 2000s, where things were just being cut and costs were just constantly, they were just trying to save every penny they could. Yeah. But the company was still taking risks in that period, in that decade. From 1995 to 2005, they opened up Hong Kong Disneyland. They opened up Animal Kingdom, DCA, Walt Disney Studio Park. And whilst they weren't critically acclaimed, they were, and you know, people might argue this, but they were damaging the brand. They were still generating jobs. They were generating income. Whereas now we're just seeing costs cut.
Yeah.
Which is sacrificing jobs. It's sacrificing people's positions within the company. And Disney is just relentless with how they're doing this. They're just going through and they're just taking out as much as possible without really taking any risks. And in my opinion, it's just starting to look like, whereas Disney in that era was complacent with their brand, they're almost doing the same thing now where they're like, we're Disney. We can pretty much get away with anything.
People are going to pay us money no matter what. Which I think it's a good point now to talk about the kind of links between this plan, Project Gemini, and what Epcot was meant to get. Because you remember in 2017, they showed that blue sky concept art of Epcot, and it looked very close to Project Gemini. It had all the green space, the trees, the communicable buildings were completely gone and replaced with winding paths and waterfalls and stuff like that. But then when they showed them in 2009, half of the communicable interventions building remained, and there was still, you know, some greenery and trees and stuff like that. But now in 2020, they've knocked down a quarter of communicable and... with everything going on and all the costs being cut all over the place, who knows what's going to end up at Epcot. And it has needed this refurbishment it's in the middle of since before Project Gemini. And this was 20 years ago. It has needed a refurb of even bigger than the scale it's getting for, you know, 25 years at this point. And who knows what we're going to get now. We'll probably get Guardians, Ratatouille, and I would say that's about it.
The rumor I've heard with some of the demolition that they've been doing at Epcot is they've pretty much been sitting there going, so what can we salvage?
Yeah, what's past the point of no return? And what can we chuck in that communicable building? Maybe, you know, an internet cafe, maybe cool stuff? Or can we bring back some of the Gemini plans?
The robot restaurant, baby.
It's back. But yeah, I think Project Gemini for me is a quick little last wrap up. Project Gemini for me is that good idea in theory, but needed a lot of refinement until it was the right fit for Epcot. Epcot needed more rides, but it didn't just need more stuff chucked in for the sake of chucking more stuff in. What are your final thoughts about Project Gemini? Do you think it would have worked? Do you think it was never going to get off the ground?
If it was going off my hopeful outcome that it would be, you know, they'd take this top level concept and then expand on all of the ideas, I do think that there are some aspects of this that would have affected Epcot in the long term. However, it would have still been very top level. And I think the latest expansion that they've done have sort of ironed out some of the more problematic parts of Future Worlds and the early part, trying to steer away from that whole idea of a permanent World's Fair and more embrace something that's more along the lines of the Disney brand. But in saying that, it's still, you know, if you look at even the most common, not the most common, but the latest Epcot expansion concept art, it is something that may in 10 or 20 years appear outdated because it's going back off those 1970s and 1980s trends. It's trying to embrace an Epcot that was there, you know, before. It's essentially taking you back in time. But as we know from fashion and from gadgets and any sort of different trends, trends are on a circle, and eventually what is back in fashion will go out of fashion. So who knows? Epcot, I unfortunately think, will always be a problem child for the Disney brand.
Yeah, it's a shame. But I think that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Review Time podcast. What do you think? Do you think Project Gemini would have worked? You can get in touch with us on Twitter and let us know your thoughts. I am at Review Time Luke.
I am at Review Time Dom.
You can get in touch with both of us at Time Review. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, all the others at Review Time. Next week, we'll be back with another episode of the Review Time podcast where Dom is bringing an attraction to me. Thanks for listening. See ya.
Bye.
The Review Time podcast is brought to you by Luke Carroll and Dominic Lacey. We were produced gratefully by Luke Shacatano. A big special thanks goes out to our patrons, Jake Cool, Jane McRoberts, Jeremy Koufakis, Louis Najira, Peter Matthews, Ruben Mays, Ray Dredge, John Madison, Michael Pinn, Janine Kerr, CG Lemonade, Josh Guilas, Tim Descenzo, Josie McDougall, Stephen Shorrock, Matt Sakal, and to you, the listener. The Review Time podcast will be back next week.